This is the Blue Moon Podcast. Coming up, we've got all the news and views from Manchester City's week. It's your club, and this is your show.
Well, it's amazing what two wins can do for your perceptions of a week, isn't it? Three Premier League points and safe passage to the League Cup semi-finals seems simple enough. But it wasn't all plain sailing for City. The question is, despite all of that, did they actually play well? The next question, I suppose, is, do you care? Either way, the outcome is the same after all. On today's Blue Moon Podcast, we'll be looking over the games against Southampton and Arsenal. Plus, we'll check in with fans of Newcastle and Everton to find out what's in store for City in this festive period. Sam Roscoe takes us back to the last time City weren't in the top four on Christmas Day. And spoiler alert, it's actually quite a while ago. And we'll speak to historian Gary James about the time City played on December the 25th in years gone by. I'm David Mooney. I'm joined by two City fans this week. I've got Howard Hocking.
Hello.
And from statcity.co.uk, Adam Carter.
Hello.
So, gents, a win's a win. Howard, I mean, I don't think either game particularly set the world on fire, but, you know, 3 points and in the semi-finals, can't ask more than that, can you?
No, well, if I go in reverse order, the Carabao Cup, we don't have to play well. So, I mean, down the last 3 years, the number of poor performances from City I've seen, and we've still gone through anyway, I don't know if you really take much from it anyway. And I don't think despite our dominance over Arsenal in many games recently, I don't think we've scored four against them at Arsenal. I think Rich Jolly said online since 1961, so I'll definitely take that. And Southampton was just about the result, really. I get away into that game very anxious, to be honest, especially as Liverpool had already won resoundedly. And I just felt, I never thought we'd just all our problems were going to fizzle away that day and all come together. I just wanted to see us put some sort of a performance together. And they did that, and they won. And, you know, it was an entertaining game. So all in all, it has been a good few days for City, and I think much needed, really, because, yeah, the mood was quite low.
Let's be honest, Adam. When Arsenal equalised, it was against the run of play, but City hadn't created much, had they? That's the nooks of the matter here, isn't it?
Yeah, it felt a bit of here we go again. We seem to start games well and then shoot ourselves in the foot, and it becomes a slog after we've scored, and that was evident again tonight. I think it's a weird one that the scoreline actually says we battered them 4-1, and you take that every day, but it wasn't actually a 4-1 game. However bad Arsenal were, we weren't as fluid in the opening, certainly 55 minutes of that game, as you'd like to be. So it's just, it was kind of a grind again, much like the last few games before that. The West Brom and United draws actually feel like defeats, but I was looking before, it's actually only one defeat in the last 19 games, but it seems like we've absolutely just meandered on through this season. It's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, though, Howard, you'd say they weren't taking their chances at Southampton, and we'll come on to that shortly, but they did take their chances against Arsenal because, I mean, it was three goals from the first three shots of the second half, and we've been crying out for City this season, take your bloody chances.
Well, let's be honest, not every week that you just hit it straight at the keeper and he throws it into his net.
So, I mean, Liverpool have been getting away with that for years. Well,
Liverpool, yes, but we're not Liverpool. I cannot remember. I think Paddy Kelly or someone's the last goalkeeper I remember just handing a goal to us. It just doesn't seem to happen very often. It's great that. It's great stuff. However it goes in, that's great that we... Obviously, Jesus missed an excellent chance in the first half, but to have taken our chances, obviously, glad of no VAR for Phil Foden's goal. But we took the chances, you know. It's just after that West Brom game still scars me that, or even the Southampton, thank God we're winning against Southampton going into that 90th minute, because we had players who didn't want to shoot from 3 yards out. So it's really nice. However it happens, it's just really nice to see that four on the scoreboard, because as you say, they took chances. Couple of headers was there, and kind of scored from the corner too, so plenty of positive to take from that. Yeah. And let's be honest, yeah, there was a bit of luck with one of the goals and whatnot, but again, Arsenal, yeah, the commentary was bizarre on Sky for Alan Smith. It was like Arsenal fan TV, but obviously less aggressive. It was Arsenal only had two shots, I think, I can remember the goal and one very late on from Pepe of any note in 90 minutes. So whether the score was flattering or not, City were clearly the better side.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, Adam, we've been trying to get a kind of some sort of shape of the old City, and I'm sitting here wondering, am I asking too much of this team? Because for weeks and weeks and weeks, well, for all of last season, I was saying, look, sort this defence out, stop conceding stupid goals. And they've done that. They're not conceding stupid goals at the moment. The one against Arsenal, okay, Laporte's the wrong side of his man, but you know it's seven clean sheets in eight games before that, so they're doing something right. And you know, I'm sitting here going, yeah, but you know they're getting clean sheets, but they're not scoring goals. I'm like, what is it that I want? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, and it's weird how it's ended up seeming to cost us at the other end of the pitch. You can only have one or the other. Which one is it? Do you want clean sheets or do you want goals? Ideally, you want both, and that's how you win games. But I think we've been crying out since Kompany left for that, like you say, that sturdy defence, and Pep finally has got it right. I think it's probably the best defensive stats you could have under Pep that we've had under Pep. So, and then our forward line have just, you know, just avoided scoring for the last few games. So I think now this could really spear us on for a bit of a run now. Like Howard touched on there, we've taken our chances, and in previous games we've looked petrified, and that weighs on strikers and attackers. Yeah. Bernardo, rather than taking a shot, decided to chip it back into seven Southampton players in the previous game. So it's obviously been a mentality thing where we've been struggling up front in front of goal. But when you're coming off the back of four goals scored, and like you mentioned, three of them were with our first three attempts on target, you'd hopefully that rubs off and then sets us off into the festive period nicely.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing though, Adam, how much of the fact that City have scored five goals this week, how much of that is down to the fact that they haven't played teams that have put 11 men behind the ball?
Yeah, we always prefer playing teams that are going to try and match us, don't we? We struggle with that low block. It's been well documented in previous podcasts. If someone comes and tries to play us, we'll do all right. I fancy us against anyone who tries to play us, unless it's Liverpool. So hopefully we'll face a different proposition in Newcastle and Everton. I can't see them, you know, trying to put too many men behind the ball. Newcastle maybe more so than Everton, but hopefully when we do get those chances, we'll take them.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing that the goal at Southampton, especially Howard, it was like the old City under Guardiola. They got to the byline, they drilled it back across, and there was it wasn't a tap in for Sterling, it wasn't a gimme, it was a nice finish. But you know, you'd expect him to score.
Literally the first thing I said when the score went, that's what we used to do. That's a goal from 2 years ago. We've done it. You know, it's just like, just so rare that you have the overlap. It's the overlaps that we're missing, really, be it a fullback or be it any wide player. Just, it's bizarre how we just don't get behind teams. And especially, and Southampton aren't one of these teams, of course, especially teams that are just going to sit and play dead in the penalty area. It's amazing that we don't use width and we don't use the overlaps as much. It just, you know, the days of Sterling and Sané on each side of width and speed, and it was nice to score a goal like that. It's just such a classic City goal from earlier in the Pep era.
Yeah, do you know what else would have been a classic City goal though, Howard?
Well, it's not one from a corner, so what is it?
No, it's the one that Adam mentioned, where Bernardo Silva is pretty much clean through on goal from about 8 yards out on his stronger foot. And for whatever reason, I'm not having chip to the back post to Mahrez. I've never seen anybody really cross a ball harder than that. You know, he gave him a volley by just wanging it at the back post, Sam Lee said on our podcast. And it's like, he's right. He just smashed it at the back post. So there's times, isn't there, Howard, where you go, look, just have a shot. Just have a shot. You're in a good position. Have a shot.
What is it there? It must be a lack of confidence. Yep. But why would a lack of confidence when you're 5 yards out stop you from just putting a shot in? I mean, I don't understand why that would make you go, oh, no, I'll try and cuss it to the other side of the area instead. I don't understand. It was twice. I mean, Bernardo, I thought I'd, you know, we're desperate to see the debut season, Bernardo Silva, and we, you know, try and pick up on anything. But I think I am seeing a bit of it, and a lot of it's just work ethic, because he always just motored around the pitch and, you know, put in a lot of effort. And we saw that with him, but yet it's tarnished, because in two brilliant positions, he just won't shoot. And it's what's makes it more annoying is that other clubs we're up against, you know, our rivals, are scoring for fun. because they shoot.
Yeah.
Everyone else shoots. West Brom shoot. You know, you just don't just get in that position. And they've got to sat down, these players, and be shown those videos and told, just do not do that again. If you ever see get that close to goal, you shoot. Because even that one he crossed from Mahrez, even if he just shot on goal to the far post, even if the keeper parried it and Mahrez was running in and might have got to it. So you've kind of got two chances at a goal there. So.
Yeah. I just think, though, Adam, maybe it's getting to them. Do you know what I mean? They get into good positions and they're going, God, we're not taking chances. And Bernardo gets there and he maybe thinks, well, you know, Riyad's got an open goal at the back post.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's weighing on them. And the more it happens, the more it becomes a thing. So unless Bernardo had a tenner on himself to provide an assist in that game, that's the only reason I can think of. Like Howard says, you shoot across the goal there, you either get a tap in at the back post, you create another chance from the keeper pushing it out, or you score yourself. And I think, that, like I say, the more this goes on, the more it becomes a thing, the more people recognise it, the more it's talked about, the more pressure it heaps on them. I think we could do with seeing Aguero running the team from Aguero, and he'll take some chances, and hopefully that's the monkey off the back then.
Yeah, because Howard, there was also De Bruyne snatched an early shot on the counter-attack where you'd expect him to score. Sterling, there was one where I think it was Cancelo who was running past him, and he was clearly opening up the space for Sterling to shoot, and he tries to play a pass into him. To what's he going to do with it? You know, you can hear the frustration in my voice. Just hit it.
Well, it's just there's players out of form. Simple as that. I mean, Ryan said it's just out of form. And I do wonder if that is a confidence thing. Don't know if Leon scarred him. I always thought it's not the World Cup final, but he stepped up to take that penalty for England against Iceland. Was it in the summer? This year it's just a blur.
Yeah, I don't know.
And I thought, he stepped up and got the, you know, it proved to be the winning goal. I thought, oh no, not Raheem Sterling on a penalty for England. And I thought, well, that shows his confidence doesn't falter, that the Leon thing hasn't affected him, and, you know, everything's going to be fine. But it just looks completely devoid of confidence. So with Kevin De Bruyne, he's shooting, his radar's not there. The assists are still there, passes are still there a lot of the time, but he's lost the lethal touch in front of the goal, you know, hit the woodwork a few times, but I don't know what it is. I really don't know sometimes. With him, I really do think he looks fatigued mentally and physically because, you know, football has been non-stop. But with Ryan Sterling, I think it is more a confidence issue.
Yeah, probably a good thing in that case that Sterling or De Bruyne didn't make it onto the pitch against Arsenal then, really, Howard.
Oh, yeah, exactly. I mean, Kevin De Bruyne, I just want to see have a rest. Ryan Sterling, I'm not sure, deserves a starting place right now. I mean, it's a temporary thing that we have no, you know, sort of looking at Phil Foden tonight, I thought, God, he's having a poor game as well. And he's been out of form for a while. By the end of the game, he'd completely rectified that problem and was, you know, absolutely bossing it by the end of the game. I don't have issues about the quality of these players. It's just of the moment, really. You know, there's players that seem to be struggling, and I don't know if they're just tired or it's just the motivation in what is a very strange season in empty stadiums. And, you know, some teams and some players deal with it better than others.
I was going to mention Foden, Adam, because the very fact, I mean, okay, it probably would have been VAR'd offside if it was in the league, but the very fact that he got on the score sheet against Arsenal, it's huge, isn't it?
Yeah, and he got an assist as well. So, you know, it was a great delivery for Laporte's goal. So recently, I've been clamouring for Foden to start, and I always find recently with City, the players who are on the bench have the best games because the players on the pitch have been a bit poor. So, like Stones, for example, tonight, when Laporte made his error, I'm thinking, well, there's Stones starting at the weekend. Foden, the same, when I've been clamouring for him to come off the bench. And there's been a couple of games recently where he's not quite reached those levels. And again, I agree with Howard. I thought the start of tonight was another one of those games where Foden was a bit ineffective, but he grew into the game, took his goal well. We're lucky with VAR, it would have been chalked off. And then his assist, like I say, was perfect as well. So he's having more and more of an impact on games more and more often now, Foden. It's brilliant to see.
Let's just touch on the defence, though, because as much as we've said that City maybe didn't play too well in these two games, Arsenal scored with pretty much their only chance, as Howard said. Southampton, I don't really remember Edison having that much to do beyond catching a few crosses. So, Howard, are you more confident in this defence at the moment?
Oh, God, yeah. Absolutely. We don't say that, but it's not been. I mean, it wasn't against Southampton. I hate that phrase, double pivot. It's not always been that, but, you know, just a more withdrawn midfielder sometimes alongside Rodri. And obviously the Diaz effect of him coming in and John Stones just, you know, rebought just the John Stones of a couple of years ago. So I am. And to be honest, I think I've said it elsewhere. If Southampton played at home against any side in the league, and you know, Liverpool, United, Chelsea, City, they would create some chances. They're an excellent side with an excellent manager who are absolutely flying at the moment. So the fact that they did have a few, you know, sniffs at goal and the odd half chance, I'm fine with that. We can't start thinking that, you know, any time the opposition have a chance, it's a disaster. I thought we contained them pretty well, to be honest. And it's just now, it's just a case of, you know, so kind of dealt with that. I mean, it was a club record, that 6 clean sheets on the row.
And, yeah, never quite made it to 7, though, did they? That's the thing.
Well, just one deflected goal. Yeah, ridiculous deflected goal. And we could easily have got to 8. And, yeah. Yeah, we just need to now convert the domination we have with the ball as well at the same time and just be more clinical up front.
Yeah. Final question, Adam. You mentioned it a couple of minutes ago. Is Laporte in a bit of trouble at the moment with City? Because he's at fault, quite a bit at fault for Arsenal's goal. Can't really get in the team at the moment.
Yeah, I've been overly critical of Laporte recently. I was disgusted with his error against Tottenham. Pep came out after the game and said we knew Kane was going to come short and Son was going to run in behind. We'd worked on it all week in training, and then 3 minutes into the game, that exact thing happens. So when he gets dropped, and he was publicly dropped, we've known for a few games, 6 or 7 games now, that he's been dropped for that mistake. When he does come back in, and because of Stone's good form, every mistake that Laporte makes is going to be magnified. And I was looking when the cross came in for Arsenal's equaliser to say, where's Laporte? And he was the wrong side of Lacazette, then trying to get in front of him. And I think any other game, in any other season for Laporte, you probably wouldn't be that harsh on him. But because the magnifying glass is on him so much now, it just amplifies tenfold. And I don't think he's done enough with his goal tonight to warrant being back in the team ahead of Stone. So he's got a mountain to climb now, which is absolutely bizarre, because last season and the season before, he was one of the two best centre-backs in the Premier League.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense, does it?
I do think he was covering a bit for Zinchenko.
He was.
But he should always be concentrating on the guy that's in front of him. Yeah. But that's the thing with Zinchenko. He's not a left-back, and I think one of his weakest parts of his defending is drifting in and covering that far post for crosses that come in, and I think Laporte was wary of that. And I did think Laporte grew into the game as well, because he hasn't played really. But yeah, it is very weird, isn't it? You know, considering that we start the season with him probably being one of the first names on the team sheet. So.
Yeah, now can't get a game. It's funny how things change in a couple of months, isn't it? Well, we always think of football's tradition being games on Boxing Day and New Year's Day, but as late as the 1960s, there were English League matches played on Christmas Day. City's record wasn't great. Obviously, it's City we're talking about, so obviously it wasn't great. I've been speaking to football historian Dr. Gary James to find out more about how the club has done on December the 25th in years gone by.
The last one was in 1957 against Burnley, and, you know, players like, you know, for example, Bert Trout when playing in that game, Dave Ewing, Roy Little, but, you know, some of the names that people will be familiar with, you know, certainly Bert Trout, obviously. And so, yeah, it's certainly living memory. In fact, Bill Leavers, who played in that game, is still alive and so on. So it's something that, I always think of, oh, Christmas Day, it's like a Victorian postcard or something, or a Christmas card or something, you know, a snowy scene and a few people in long sort of shorts playing football with big, heavy jerseys on and stuff. But no, it's living memory. Now, that one in 57-58, we lost, which we tended to do on Christmas Day, unfortunately. But this was sort of typical of the way the Christmas games used to work, because you'd play home or away on Christmas Day, and then the next day, quite often, you'd play the same team again at the other ground. So the last Christmas Day game was against Burnley at Turf Moor, which wasn't a happy place for us. It was a 2-1 defeat. And then the next day, Burnley came to Main Road and we beat them 4-1. The crowd for that game was just, 47,285. So, you know, these were quite often were perceived as big, important sort of derby matches as well.
I just looking at the teams that City have played on Christmas Day, because I always, in the back of my head, I always thought it'd be a lot of local derbies just because of ease of travel and that sort of thing. But there's some decent trips in there that City have made. I mean, there's a trip to Chelsea in there a couple of times. In fact, Chelsea, they went there twice. Plymouth had to come to Main Road as well at one year.
Well, yeah, I mean, Chelsea is the sort of furthest we've travelled on Christmas Day. But in 1946-47, we played Plymouth at home on Christmas Day, which we won 4-3. And then the next day, we're actually away at Plymouth. So from what I remember, I did some research about a few years back, and I think the two teams actually travelled down to Plymouth together on a train overnight, maybe on Christmas Day. So it's bizarre, isn't it? You know, and now we talk about not just this year, but most years, over Christmas period, you expect a lot of travel to shut down. Boxing Day is a nightmare usually a nightmare to get anywhere. And certainly Christmas Day was out of the question trying to get anywhere. But these football teams, at a time when there wasn't widespread sort of coach travel or anything like that, are expected to travel from one end of the country to the other.
Let's go all the way back to City's first Christmas Day game back in 1896. And again, it was looking at the local derby nature of it all. It was Manchester United for three of the first, first six games or so?
Yeah, well, the very first one was in 1896 and we lost 2-1. It was at Bank Street, which is, for anyone who doesn't know, it's actually next door to where the Velodrome is. Now there's a BMX centre, and that was basically where United's ground was in 1896. We lost that one. But the interesting thing about that was because it was obviously a local derby, and so it was by far United's biggest crowd of a season. It was 18,000, which was described as being enormous for United at the time, and it was certainly bigger than any other crowd United had that season. But the main sort of aspects of that when it was reported, like years ago, I was doing some research on derby matches and we struggled to find a detailed match report of that game because it was Christmas Day. But what we did find was comments in the newspapers for the rest of that week talking about how the crowd was so huge. Obviously, it's only 18,000, but for the time it was huge, that people were constantly getting onto the pitch. And it was, it was difficult. People couldn't watch the game because fans were all over the place and all sorts of, chaotic scenes. But Joshua Palbe, who was a member of the league management committee, but more importantly, from our point of view, was an ex-City manager and was a director of City, but was supposedly attending the game as a member of the league management committee. He ended up making an announcement to the crowd and he basically said that if you do not get off the pitch, the game would be abandoned, and Newton Heath, which is Manchester United, would have to suffer consequences. Now, this happened after City were losing, so I can't help thinking Josh was thinking, you know what, we could actually save today by abandoning this game.
We're get the City fans on the pitch, yeah.
Yeah, everyone on the pitch, which of course is a trick United tried all those years later with the Dennis Law relegation game. But that was 18,000, which was described as huge. But by the time we had the last sort of derby day on Christmas Day, which was in 1902, it was a one-all draw again at Clayton. But by that time, there's 40,000 people there, which shows the way, well, certainly the way United's crowds had increased, but the way football crowds had increased. And the derby then was typically sort of 40,000 sellout, whether it was at United or at City.
Yeah, let's talk Main Road, because obviously City moved to Main Road during this period that they were playing on Christmas Day. The first one, again, City being City, they lost to West Brom in 1924.
Yeah, 24-25, it wasn't a sort of a great period. At that point, City were still sort of blaming the move from Main Road. I mean, the first year after the move to Main Road, got big crowds. The move sort of propelled City forward to some extent, but the pitch just was not good. And it, by 1924, people were still moaning, and the guy, the architect, was being blamed for it. And so, you know, in the end, we got relegated. It was a year after, but you know, we were struggling and struggling. And so it wasn't great. And obviously, the year after, in 1925-26, we got beat 6-5 by Bury, which is by far the sort of biggest result on Christmas Day for us in terms of goals in the game. But it was a 6-5 defeat. And by that time, Alois Alexander, who was one of the directors, officially he was acting manager, but he managed the club for, it was a bit like when Phil Neal managed us back in the 90s. He was never permanently the manager, but he managed us for most of the season in the end. Yeah. And it was a season we got relegated. So it was the 20s. I mean, we had a lot of games on Christmas Day in the 20s, but yeah, they weren't so great. You know, if you actually look at all the results for the 1920s, we're, you know, 26-27, we lost 5-3 in Division 2. The year after, we lost 4-0. You know, not great results, really.
Yeah. Just finally looking at the managers of that time as well, because there's been some change, but it was Les McDowell who managed the most games on Christmas Day alongside Ernest Magnall. McDowell obviously got the most wins on Christmas Day as well. It seemed like it was it kind of heading towards City's golden period in the 60s, if that makes sense.
Yeah, maybe. It was a shame that we stopped playing on Christmas Day, really. But yeah, I mean, Les McDowell managed the club for a long, long time. Was a great, great manager. And I always think, although, you know, I was born at the end of the 60s, but the 1950s, feels sort of touching distance still. I know it's 70 years ago, but for me, it sort of feels like touching distance. And I've interviewed quite a lot of people from that sort of period. So these sort of games and names mean a great deal. But Les McDowell was a great tactician, really. I suppose, I was going to say the pep of his day, but Les quite often would be perceived as being this tactical genius and would come up with various ideas and various plans. But unfortunately, you know, overall, City still didn't have a great record on Christmas Day. I mean, when you look at the full stats, we played, 36 games on Christmas Day. We won 10, drew 9, lost 17. Not great. There's one season, 1936-37, though, that I think it's probably just worth saying something about. We lost 5-3 at Grimsby on Christmas Day, so not a great result on Christmas Day. But the next day, on Boxing Day, we beat Middlesbrough 2-1, and that was the start of a 22-game unbeaten run that then brought City the title. So that season, even though we had an awful Christmas Day, it was the turning point. The day after was the turning point, if you like, Boxing Day. And I think when you look at a lot of these games, they sort of come just in the middle of the season, obviously Christmas Day, when you either, it sort of sets the tone for what's to follow, or in some ways it's the last chance. I remember years ago being told, actually, yeah, it fits with the 1950s. Bobby Johnston, who was a great, great City player, he enjoyed, let's just say, he lived above a pub and he enjoyed his Christmases and New Year. And although it's not quite Christmas Day, it's more a New Year's Day story, but because he lived across above the pub, he wasn't always in the best he wasn't for peak fitness on match day. And this one particular, I think it was New Year's Day, this one particular day, he said to the other players, look, today, ball to feet. No, do not send the ball to my head. Ball to my feet all the time. And so, of course, what did Ken Barnes and all the other players do? Throughout the game, ball straight to his head. and he actually scored with his head during the game. So, you know, so I suppose he fought through his I was going to say pain, but I suppose it's more joy, I suppose, of what he was doing the night before.
For a pledge of $2 a month, you can hear our weekly bonus show on a wide range of City topics. There's more details on patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast.
That was Gary James speaking to me about City's performances on previous Christmas days. All the data for that interview came from you, Adam, statcity.co.uk, if you want more information. So thank you very much for that. It was fascinating.
Yeah, a bit rubbish when you asked me to look at it. I thought, oh yeah, Christmas Day, festivities, and then we're actually really poor on Christmas Day, so you're more than welcome, though.
Yeah, good job we stopped playing on Christmas Day, really, wasn't it?
Definitely.
Yeah. Time to look ahead at the game with Newcastle on Boxing Day for this year. And to do that, we're joined by Taylor Payne from Pod on the Tyne. Hi, Taylor.
Hello, how are we doing?
I'm not too bad, thanks. Welcome to the show. I don't want to characterise Newcastle United in a certain way, but it always seems to be a roller coaster for you guys. So how are things at the moment?
Well, it's often like an episode of Coronation Street, isn't it, our team? It's sort of, you know, you get a set up at the start and everything seems okay, and then steadily things just go to bits, don't they, as the episode goes on. Yeah, things are weird at the minute. We have no consistency whatsoever. We seem to lurch from one sort of close disaster, and then we pull it back and we might get a draw or we get 3 points, and then the next game we go back to being utter dross again. So there's just no consistency. I don't know what to think anymore about this team. I don't know whether we're any good or not. We are not. We're rubbish, but that's just how I feel.
Oh, I don't know about you, Howard, but that screams Manchester City 2002 to about 2009, doesn't it?
Well, you could pick that one, or you could pick plenty of others. So. Well, that's the thing with Newcastle. They do well enough, and Steve Bruce does well enough to really compel change in a way. And obviously the false dawns. That sums up City in the past. It's the hope, isn't it, that something better's around the corner, and Newcastle have had that this year and had it, at least for now anyway, just taken away from them. And that's what keeps you going as a football fan. It's, in a way, mediocrity is the worst place to be, because you're just stuck in no man's land, just plodding along. And I really wanted Newcastle to be taken over, because it would have just shaken up and annoyed a lot of people. But maybe in the near future.
Is there any hope of that on the horizon now, Taylor, or has it just died again?
Well, there's been whisperings of legal action and all kinds of stuff over the last few weeks. And while it still keeps the conversation going, I think most Newcastle fans are just sick of it now, because we had it for the entirety of the lockdown. When the first lockdown happened, it kind of coincided with the story break, and then everyone was suddenly very excited. But then we had nothing to do and nothing to think about apart from the takeover. So I think it slowly drove a lot of us completely mad, myself included, and the guys on the podcast, because it felt like we were talking about it every 5 minutes and there was no other stories, because there was no football. And there was no life. There was just takeover and waiting to see if it happened or not. And it kind of, you know, it went on and on and on. And I think eventually people just got sick of it. And I think now it's just rumbling away in the background. Will it happen? I think it's the daftest question in the world, because I don't think anybody knows. Mike actually doesn't even know at the minute. But I agree completely with what you said before there, that it would have shook the tree massively. And I think there's an awful lot of people stand to lose an awful lot if Newcastle get taken over. And one thing we know about people who have a lot is that they don't like to lose it. So, you know, we'll see what happens with it. But, you know, fingers crossed. I mean, it wasn't the best situation anyway, because I wasn't overly keen on the people who were taking us over, or who were reported to be taking us over, and, you know, some of the stuff that goes along with them. But if you look at it purely from a football fan's point of view, you have to say, well, it's what the club needs. The club needs an influx of cash, and it needs a bit of direction. And at the minute, it hasn't got that. So
yeah, I mean, the story for a long time in Newcastle has been kind of like the Newcastle fans against Mike Ashley. Where is all that at the moment? How's the feeling at the moment?
I think we've just kind of shaken hands and called it a draw. I think we've kind of went, you know, you're not going to win. We're not going to win. We might as well just leave this until somebody else comes along with the money. I think most Newcastle fans realise that the root problem at the club is Mike Ashley. I mean, you can blame Steve Bruce for and the players for the week-to-week performances and how the team are set up and all that kind of stuff. But ultimately, if it wasn't for Mike Ashley, Steve Bruce wouldn't have a job. Or he would, but it wouldn't be at Newcastle United. So I think we still feel like Ashley is at fault for a lot of what's gone on in the club in the past and currently. But I think we realise now that it's never going to change. And he is just the way he is. He's not going to suddenly become this, you know, this benevolent benefactor of billions of pounds and just say, right, go out and buy whoever you want and do whatever you want with the training ground and do whatever you want to the stadium and I'll just fund it. He's not that kind of guy. So we have to realise that that's not going to be the case until he goes. But we need a buyer. That's the thing. That's always been the issue with this, is that you need somebody to come along who's got the money to do it.
Yeah. Adam, given the weekend's revision to the Christmas rules, I'm guessing there's probably not going to be any fans in the stadium for this one when it looked like there might have been. Is that going to make a difference for you? Were you planning to apply for the tickets or anything like that?
I wasn't. I'm waiting for everyone to be back in, kind of one for all and all for one approach. But there'll be a lot of disappointed people for sure. The rule changes, you know, at the last minute, people have made plans and entered ballots and stuff and made provisions. So it's going to be a weird one where you're expecting there should have been fans there. I think for City as a team, we've not had fans back in the stadium yet, so it won't affect our mindset too much. So nothing ventured, nothing lost, I suppose, on that front.
Yeah. Taylor, have you had fans back in St James's yet?
No, and I think it's probably just as well, to be honest.
would anyone have applied for the ballot?
I don't think so, no. I think Steve Bruce's position would have been made a lot more difficult over the last few weeks if there had been fans in the ground, I think. I think he's gotten away with it a little bit because we've seen a few years ago we stopped Alan Pardew getting out of the dugout during a game against Cardiff because we weren't happy with him. He literally, every time he stood about his chair, there was just a chorus of boos and, you know, names, of which I won't repeat. And he couldn't get out of his dugout. And I think Steve Bruce might have been in a similar position. And now I understand that there's a lot of people who say, well, you know, there's a lot of clubs who've got it a lot worse than you and that sort of thing. And, you know, you could be Sunderland. And let's all be honest, we don't want that. But at the minute, I think the thing that most fans are so unhappy about is that everything's just so turgid and backwards and the football is just absolutely god-awful. So, you know, I think he would be in trouble if there'd been fans on the ground.
Yeah, with that in mind, the football being god-awful, how do you anticipate Newcastle setting up for this one?
I think we'll go for a flat back nine. with Callum Wilson wandering around on the halfway line aimlessly with his hands in his pockets, basically. I think that's what we'll go for with City. Now, historically, over the last few years, I mean, even Rafa set us up very defensively against City, and I think
worked, you know, a couple of times.
Well, this is it. We nearly got results out of those games, and the reason why it worked is because when Rafa set us up defensively like that, there was a reason behind it, and there was a strategy and a plan. And it was to try and sort of contain, and then when the game got stretched and City started getting tired, we could hit them on a break, or we could give them a cheeky sucker punch. You know, with Steve Bruce. And I'm not one for constantly going on about the comparison between Rafa and Steve Bruce, and I think it doesn't benefit anybody to go on about that. But with that in mind, when Steve Bruce sets up against what we call elite teams or top four teams, he relinquishes the ball completely. The team drop right off, but we're so passive with it as well. There isn't an attempt to make a tackle. It's essentially you have the ball until you either shoot and score, or shoot and miss, and then we'll have the ball, and then we'll give it back to you, and then you can do the same again. So, which is the reason why we faced more shots than any team in the league, why Carl Darlow's made more saves than every goalkeeper in the league, why Federico Fernandez has made more blocks than any player in the league. So, you know, the stats are there to back it up. It's when we're not particularly progressive, put it that way.
Yeah, Howard, when you hear that, how do you because I mean, there's two words that spring to mind at the Etihad recently, and that's West Brom.
Well, no, we've just described everything City team hates. So a team that plays dead is a team, you know, we hate to play against because we've really struggled to break down teams that don't want the ball and don't want to attack. And, you know, at least last weekend, at least Southampton wanted to play a game and it was so more entertaining for it. The question is, I don't know. Yeah, with Newcastle, they are quite erratic as well.
that's a nice word for it, yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's the discipline needed to do that. I mean, I don't think it's that difficult to do. That's where City's problems have come from, that so many opposition teams find it quite easy just to sit in that area and play passive. Yeah. But if Newcastle do that, then if City get an early goal, it's, you know, it's different in a way, though. Probably thought that when we scored in the first half against West Brom. But if we don't, then it just becomes a problem again. I mean, it's obviously one we should win easily, especially with all these clean sheets under our belt. But if that penalty, if the opposition penalty area is just full of players for 90 minutes, then well, we've been here many times before. And yeah. I can see it being another frustrating night.
Yeah, Adam, do you get that sense that other teams sometimes sense an opportunity at City at the moment? If they can keep things tight and compact, City can just, they can have shots for fun from the edge of the box, but they're going to fly high, wide and handsome all the time.
Yeah, I think we're really easy to play against if you set up like that. If you don't want anything from the game more than a draw or to snatch a sucker punch, we're really easy to sit back against. We lack that killer instinct in front of goal. We seem petrified to take a shot, and it will be limited to snapshots from outside the area that go high and wide, like you say. I don't think if Newcastle want to come and play that game, I don't think they'll have any problems doing so.
Yeah. Taylor, let's just a look at Newcastle's team. You mentioned Callum Wilson. Who are the players that are likely, if to get that, if there's going to be a sucker punch, who are the players that City need to watch out for?
Well, Callum Wilson's the obvious one. I mean, he's scoring goals. A lot of them are penalties, by the way. But, you know, in order to
We can give them away.
Guaranteed gift wrap for that.
I mean, the amount of penalties in the league this season has been mad, hasn't it, since the start of the season. But, you know, if in order to get a penalty, you have to be in the opposition's box. And that's what we're not very good at. So it is tough to do that. I mean, we have some pace. We have some players who are very direct. And depending on the midfield that he plays, if he plays Jonjo Shelvey in there, who, you know, we all know has got a good range of passing, even though he can be slightly, what's the polite way of saying lazy? Well, he's lazy, isn't he? Let's be honest.
Yeah,
he's lazy. So we have options there. I don't think Sam Maximan will play, which is a shame because he's probably one of our brightest sparks, but he's been very inconsistent. But we still have a lot of players suffering from the after effects of COVID and stuff like that. We've seen players breaking down with fatigue and having to be substituted not very long into games. Freddy Fernandez the other day had that problem. Do you know what? It's anyone's guess of what team we'll be able to put out. But Miggy Almiron could cause some problems on the break, but he seems to be able to run in a straight line and nowhere else. As long as he's got an open pitch in front of him. He's like, you know, when you see people doing the land speed record, so they have to have like 15 mile of straight track ahead of them. Yeah, he's like that. He's put the ball in front of him and he'll run forever, but ask him to turn a corner and he's knackered. So I don't know. It's a tricky one for us, but if we get a chance, Callum Wilson's always there and there's always a chance he takes it, as long as it falls to him. If it falls to Joe Linton, the ball ain't going in the net, unfortunately. That's just the way things are.
Well, we've got a charity bet on the show coming up a bit later on. Give us your score prediction. I'll let you have mine.
3-0 City.
3-0 City. Taylor, that's wonderful. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on. Merry Christmas, lads. I hope you have a good holiday.
Yeah, you too.
Yeah, same to you.
And that brings us to the game with Everton on Monday night. I'm joined by Dave Downey from the Blue Room. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Dave. You okay?
I'm not too bad, thanks. A bit of a nosebleed for you guys at the moment, isn't it?
Well, you say that, but then, you know, just such is the way the scheduling works, and we seem to drop a place every single day since. So it's not as glamorous as it was after we saw off Arsenal. But yeah, the heady heights of the top four. Yeah, certainly a surprise at this stage of the season. Certainly a surprise after the start we had, which was ultimately paled into insignificance by some really poor defeats and performances. So I said before the Chelsea game, I'd probably taken 6 points this month. And I was sitting here with 9 after a week. So yeah, back on cloud 9.
Yeah, it's really weird because, like, for City, Howard, it's 3 wins in a row at Goodison, 5 wins in 7. I was going to ask if the Goodison hoodoo is over, but then the last thing you want right now is an Everton that are getting good results, really.
It is over in a way because obviously our record was, I know you'll have the stats, or you two, but I won't have the stats. It was appalling. So just to win there one, just nice. And I'm surprised our record is still, is that good, because I know we won some games, but it's, you know, really tough place to go to. So to be honest, I don't think that really counts. Yeah, what happened 1 year, 2 years ago just counts for absolutely nothing when we're playing next week. It's going to be a tight and very interesting game, I think. So yeah, it helps a tiny bit that we have been there and won there. But of course, in the current climate, it counts for little anyway.
Yeah, Adam, given how City have been playing in recent weeks, is this a case of which City turns up for this game?
Yeah, I think you know, you never know, we're a proper Jekyll and Hyde team. And I think Everton seems to have been like that recently as well. So I think on the day, it's going to come down to who turns up and does what they can do best. And I think whoever does that will win it. Like Howard says, it was a real hoodoo ground for us. I used to be petrified going there mid-noughties onwards, round about that Moyes era, where they just seemed to beat us 1-0 every game with a Cahill header in the 89th minute. So we do seem to have turned a corner in that respect. And I think whoever turns up on the day, if they turn up with Rodriguez and Calvert-Lewin on form, we'll be in trouble. But again, we seem to have shored up our defence. Hopefully we can take our A game there.
Yeah, Dave, this is interesting because like the Everton fans that I follow on Twitter have been quite down on this season so far, and yet here you are right in the top four in the mix for things at the top of the table. I mean, how has it got? I said, is it which City turns up? Is it which Everton turns up as well?
Yeah, I think that's spot on. I think it's a bookmaker's nightmare, I think, this game, simply because, well, you guys have been really infrequent with your results and the consistency, and other than the last three games, I mean, it's been a bit of a roller coaster for ourselves. In many ways, you become a victim of your own success. I think, obviously, you guys will have a different take on this, given the success you've had in recent years. But when you start a season like that, I'm really interested in the mentality of what a football club sort of purveys. And we won those first four games, drew against Liverpool in the derby, which is no bad result. And then we go to Southampton and Newcastle, and it didn't feel as if there was really that sort of arrogance, I think, you need to have at that point, and that confidence that you're going to blow sides away, that, you know, it doesn't matter who you're playing, the form should take care of itself because you're on such a high. And we lost those games, and it felt like it was going to be another sort of mishmash of a season where there'd be the odd good result, but ultimately it'd be mid-table to trying to hang on to the coattails of people, you know, who were challenging for European places. And then this three results have just come out absolutely nowhere. And now there's a real confidence. But more importantly, I think for us, that's much different to the start, is it's the fringe players that are starting to perform. So you look at Alex Iwobi, you look at Gylfi Sigurdsson, players that I think many of us were willing to write off. And that's probably what you've seen, Dave, on Twitter, is that people are sort of grown a little bit sick and tired of these letdowns that we will call them, simply because we wasted big money on the likes of Iwobi, Sigurdsson, our record signing for 45 million. And effectively, they still have to get a game given the squad limits that we have. And it's interesting, now we're all sitting here talking about, does James Rodriguez get back into this 11? Which I think is quite remarkable in the space of a week that we're able to possibly justify that argument. But yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think it is a Jekyll and Hyde season for ourselves. And, you know, all of a sudden now we've got a huge game with City, and it effectively the two sides sort of neck and neck in terms of positions in the Premier League. I know you guys aren't used to that, but I feel as if it's the type of game that is a momentum starter for us. Now, whilst I say that, and we've had those great results against Chelsea, Leicester, Arsenal, I see City as a different animal, a different beast, because Arsenal felt like it was not too difficult a result for us to pull off, given the plight that they're currently in. But I look at City, and I think it's the type of game that's really dangerous if you think that you're going to get something from it. And I know you've laboured to some results. The Southampton one wasn't pretty at times. But it feels to me, in the way Guardiola talks, because I listen to him every single week, and the way he speaks, I just can't help but feel somebody is going to get a real pasted soon. Because he's talking about these chances. Funnily enough, I was watching the game against Fulham, and I was looking at that thinking, you know, there's a lot of talk, I'm sure you guys talk about it all the time, about a striker, perhaps who's the long-term successor to Aguero. Is Gabriel Jesus going to provide the goals? And I was looking at City thinking, Dominic Calvert-Lewin would absolutely fly in that side, just given the plethora of chances it creates almost every single minute in games that you don't quite take at the moment. I look at that and I think, if City are going in for a striker, I'd be petrified if I'm Everton, because I could see them having a serious look at Dominic Calvert-Lewin.
I was going to ask about Calvert-Lewin simply because he's been getting the headlines this season. What's changed for him?
There's a general perspective and awareness I think he brings to this side now that isn't just one of being, you know, just flogged all over the place. I mean, you look at it, the trajectory of his career under Coombe and, you know, under Allardyce, he was basically flogged on the channels and told to run for everything, told to move out of position.
He even played at right wing back remarkably at one stage, which is, you laugh about that quite often when you look at what he's doing now. But I think when Duncan Ferguson got hold of him, I think when Ancelotti's come in, they've given him a much more focused role. I think he's always had the physical attributes and he's a natural athlete, but he's just basically been told to stick between the posts. And he's got this real knack of arriving exactly when he needs to, when a ball comes in, because we do have the luxury when he's fit of Luca Dean on the left-hand side, putting balls into the box. Seamus Coleman, probably a little bit less so on the other side. But they drill these low passes in sort of on the half volley, and he has this amazing knack of getting there ahead of the defender. He's just an absolute beast in the air. He just leap on him. I don't know if you guys saw the Merseyside derby, but the goal he scored to equalise in that game, it's ridiculous the height he gets on his jump. And a lot of us early on in his career, when you saw the sort of bare bones of him, looked at him and thought, there's Harry Kane attributes there. And by no means am I comparing him to Kane even now. I think it'd be ludicrous. But when you look at a striker that is really good at a number of things, pretty much everything you need to be as a striker, he fits that billing without being exceptional at one thing. And now each one of those facets of his game are growing more and more. And he just looks like he's going to score every single time he plays. And if he doesn't, he's the perfect isolated striker. We have games, Leicester. I was complaining at Leicester, where he's up front on his own. There's nobody within 20, 30 yards. But he's so clever in how he uses the ball when he gets it. When it goes up to him, I mean, he'll chase his own flick-ons. His chest control is brilliant. He's generally, I think, he's one. He'll definitely be in the England squad next year. I make no bones about that. But he's a top-level striker now. And I see him as somebody who will, if Everton keep him, probably break our all-time Premier League goal-scoring record, which was set by Lukaku. So, yeah, I mean, he's just completely transformed. And it's been difficult for him because we've had Allardyce, we've had Koeman. He's been played out of position. He's played second field to Lukaku when he was here. And that patience has really shown. He's the ultimate professional. Really good lad. And, yeah, he's just going from strength to strength right now.
Adam, when you look at City's defence recently as well, they've been keeping a lot of clean sheets. They've not really faced a striker like Calvert-Lewin, have they? That could be the difference in this game.
Yeah, definitely. I remember a couple of seasons ago, Calvert-Lewin came on at the Etihad and we couldn't live with him. He came on, I think he scored, and then he gave Otamendi, I think, a torrid time. So that movement that Dave mentions there, he is a real threat. Our defence have looked like we're going to be able to... We're going to be able to cope with a defender like that because of how John Stones will probably want to get one over on his old club as well. So there'll be that personal battle there between those. I'm sure they know each other. Like you say, it is our first test with this new defensive partnership that we've got, where they're facing a striker like that. We've certainly, you know, defended the box well. Whoever's been arriving at it, we've not given up many clear-cut chances with this new partnership of Diaz and Stone. So if it is that, and you've got to think the amount of games around the Christmas period, will we even see a settled back four or certainly a settled centre-back pairing to then have to deal with? I'm sure it'll feature in Pep's mind, Calvert-Lewin, how we're going to deal with him. And you've got to think on current form between the striker and our defenders, it'll be an epic battle, but I hope we come out on top, and I'd fancy us. I think John Stones might just want a personal battle with Calvert-Lewin that day.
It's funny, Howard. When you think of going to Goodison and expecting tight games in the past, I mean, in a weird way, I don't think I've ever expected a game as tight as this one's going to be. Does that make sense?
No, you expect goals, basically, because, as you say, one goal conceded in eight, roughly, we're struggling up front. So we've had to sort the defence. Otherwise, I don't know how much the two are linked. I don't think they're directly linked. I don't think we've sorted the defence and it's made us miss loads of chances. There have been games where we just haven't created much, but we have now reverted back to creating chances and just missing them and not wanting to shoot in front of goal. So I do, trying to predict this season has been impossible. I mean, just look at Everton, you know, after that start and then they tailed off and I thought, and my thoughts earlier with Everton was they've got a cracking first 11, but I'm not sure about the depth. But as Dave said, you know, the more peripheral players are putting in performances now. And both teams play at 8 o'clock on the Saturday. So 46 hours after that ends, they'll be playing again. So we're really into the unknown with this game because both teams will have to pick probably two different teams over that weekend or at least make four or five changes. So we've no we can't really predict who's going to start the game for both teams. So saying it'd be tight, I do expect it to be tight at least in the first half, because I think City will want to dominate the ball and just not give anything away. But you just don't know which players are going to walk out onto that pitch. Mm. And predicting stuff this season is just impossible. I mean, we can say, yeah, it'd be a tight game, and then it'll just be a 5-all thriller. So, no, to be honest.
Yeah, Dave, looking at how Everton are likely to set up for this one, like Howard said, it's almost impossible to predict anyway, but have a go at it. Are you likely to press at City and try and put them under pressure, or are you likely to kind of sit back and try and keep things tight?
I think we'll see a similar performance to what we saw against Chelsea, and that was basically concede that we're not going to have more of the ball than City. Sit back to a certain extent. I think Ancelotti, what the real sort of secret behind these recent decent results that we've had is the defensive line he plays. He's now fully aware and understands the deficiencies in there, and they come at centre-half by way of a lack of pace. And the real interesting one for me was the Leicester away performance. Because for years, Jamie Vardy's been the scourge of when we've gone to the King Power. Well, exactly. But that's been because we've had Michael Keane and or Yerry Mina and a couple of other defenders who've been and gone generally are quite slow. But there's been an insistence on the manager of the day to play a higher line. So Vardy can just play on the shoulder, and you know the rest of the story, don't you, when he gets in behind. Last week against Leicester, he decided to drop them a little bit deeper, I'd say about 10 yards deeper, and Vardy didn't get a sniff. The real threat, and he came from set pieces for Leicester, from corners mostly. He actually missed the sitter from a set piece, but there was none of that running in behind. There was none of those balls down the channels. It was shored up. And there's a player for you guys to seriously watch if he does play, and I expect him to, at left back, Ben Godfrey. He's been sensational. £26 million from Norwich in the summer. He's just been a revelation. He can fit in any area across the back four, can even play defensive midfield. But he's been in at left back with Lucas Digne being absent. And this guy, I mean, his pace, everything about his game, he's one of those players who does the basics sensationally well. And he's been a real star in that back four. It's interesting because it feels very negative to say this, but we've played four centre-halves in the back four because Seamus Coleman's been out, so we put Holgate in there. And like I said, Godfrey's been in for Lucas Digne and Keane and Mina. Michael Keane, by the way, starting to look every bit of the defender that we bought 4 years ago. He's really come to the fore, and he looks every bit a leader as well. He's been fantastic. And I think Ancelotti's now got to grips with the best way forward for Everton, whilst they haven't got rampaging fullbacks in the team, is to be as rigid and as structured as they possibly can in that defensive mould. And a lot of the game happens in front of them. The defenders are more comfortable with that. They shouldn't lose a header when you look at like 6'5", 6'6", with Mina and Keane. So the real secret is him being able to drop that line. And then we've had Alan, who hopefully, there's a chance he'll be fit, probably not, but it'll be a Davis and Decore or Andre Gomes and Decore in the midfield. Decore's been another great, great signing for us. I think James will come back in. It'll be James or Iwobi on the right, Richarlison on the left, and Calvert-Lewin up front. So it'll be a 4-3-3 that can sort of be quick in the transition and get more men behind the ball should it need to. And Everton will play up to Calvert-Lewin all day long and try and get bodies in and around him. So I expect Everton to sit back. I expect City to have most of the ball. But I think on the counter-attack, Everton could cause some real damage.
Yeah, well, I think the battle there in this game is going to be City's defence and Calvert-Lewin. I think that'll be the key one indeed. Dave, before we let you go, let's have a prediction for the game. We do a charity bet a bit later on and I'm crap at it, so I'm going to give mine to you.
Oh, God. I think it'll be 1-1. I think, and I bite your hand off for that, by the way, because I think City are just, if you let your guard down against this City side, I still think they've got the ability to pummel you. So I'm going to go 1-1.
Cheers, Dave. Thank you very much for being part of the show today.
No, pleasure, guys. Thanks so much.
Well, it was close, but no cigar on the charity bets for this week, so let's try and put some cash into the kitty at Christmas. Each of the panel has got a £10 correct score single from William Hill. The winnings are going to the Christie Hospital in Manchester. Two games, Newcastle and Everton. We heard from Taylor that he's predicting a 3-0 win for City against Newcastle, which is 5-1 and £50 if he's right. Howard, what are you having?
I'm going to go, fancy that, but I'm going to go 2-0 to City. Yeah. A functional victory.
A functional 2-0 victory is 11-2 and £55 if you're right. Adam, what are you having?
I'll go 1-0 City and I'll throw in Sterling first goal.
We can't have first goals, I'm afraid, but we can do 1-0. That's 17-2 and £85 if you're right. Dave Downey, we just heard a minute ago, said it would finish 1-1 at Goodison Park, which is 7-1 and £70. Howard, what are you having for this one?
Obviously, being on the eggnog, because I'm being brave here. I'm going 2-1 to City. So.
A brave 2-1 City win is 13-2 and £65 if you're right. Adam, where's your money going?
I'm going a bridge too far on that one, 2-2.
2-2 is 14-1 and £140 if you're right on that one. You've got to be 18 or over to gamble. Prices can change. And for more information on responsible gambling, have a look at begambleaware.org. Now, this season is only the third time since the Sheikh Mansour takeover that City will spend Christmas Day outside of the top four. Of course, this time there are some mitigating circumstances. They've played fewer games than in previous seasons and the table is still taking shape. On top of that, City still have a game in hand on many of the teams above them as well. Nevertheless, they're outside the top four and it's a long time since that has happened. Here's Sam Roscoe to explain more.
It's the most wonderful time of the year.
Christmas might be one of the most wonderful times of the year, but for the Premier League, it's also a pretty good indicator of how well teams are doing. And City have been doing consistently well. Both times they've been top on Christmas Day, they've gone on to win the league. And the last two titles won from a trailing position at the festive season have been City's as well. On top of that, City are the only English side to qualify for every one of the last 10 Champions League tournaments, and they've not been outside the top four at Christmas since the 25th of December 2009. That was when Roberto Mancini was brought in, after a record 7 consecutive draws left the club in 8th.
I stayed in Inter Milan for 4 years, and I won 7 trophies in 4 years. And at the end of the season, it's like me. This is our job. You stay in a club for many years, sometimes 2 years, 3 years. It depends. I don't know. But I don't want to look back, because I stay here for to train. I think and I hope to stay here for many, many years.
His first win in his first match against Stoke on Boxing Day took the team up to 6th. It was his first experience of a packed Christmas schedule.
In Italy, this is impossible, two games in 3 days. But for England, this is a normal situation. But now we must think after we recover for 1 day, and after we think the match involved.
He went on to beat Wolves and Blackburn in the next two matches too, taking City up to 4th. It was the poor form under the previous manager, Mark Hughes, that had led to a disappointing position at Christmas. But that was nothing on how it had gone for the Welshman the previous year.
It was just one of those days that you don't get very often, and it was very exciting for everybody involved, and even for people who weren't that closely involved to it. To understand the news that was coming out was great for everybody. And moving on from that day, I think the excitement surrounding the whole club and what we're trying to do here hasn't lessened in any degree.
That was Hughes speaking in his first press conference after the takeover in September 2008.
There's more attention really on ourselves, which maybe in the past has been centred on the opposition when you go up against the top four. Now actually a lot of the focus is coming to our doorstep, and that's something that we will have to deal with. But I don't sense that there's any apprehension about that. I think there's a real sense that this club is going places. That's the message we're trying to get out, and we're going to enjoy it.
Despite being the newly crowned richest club in the world, though, City were struggling. 5 wins in their first 18 matches, 2 of them before the takeover had even happened, had left City in the relegation zone on Christmas Day. It was the first and so far only time City have been in the bottom 3 on December the 25th. After a run of just 1 win in 8 games, City travelled to the Hawthorns.
Moore wants it back. Moore gets it back. He's never scored for West Brom. He has now. Mate tried to get a touch onto that. A little bit of confusion as Casado back heels it, and it's gone in. What a remarkable goal that is. Now going for it. Yes! He has done it! Seconds to go!
Despite equalising in the 86th minute, City still lost the game and sat 18th in the Premier League on Christmas Day. A run of 10 points from the next possible 12 saw them move up the table, but they missed out on any European football, finishing 10th. Ever since that season and the one after, City have both been in the top four at Christmas, and they finished in the top four as well. This year, they've had 5 or 6 games less than normal, so there's longer than usual to go. And they've a game in hand too. Pep Guardiola might not be where he wants to be this Christmas, but there's still plenty of time to put that right.
Hi, it's Nicky Weaver, and you're listening to the Blue Moon Podcast.
This is the Blue Moon Podcast. But don't worry, it'll be over soon.
Sam Roscoe there, and it's time to finish now with Ask the Panel. Get your questions in for next week at Blue Moon Podcast on Twitter. You can email us as well through the website, bluemoonpodcast.com. We're also on Instagram as well. Go and find us on there. Just search Blue Moon Podcast. NP81 on Twitter asks, now Mendy seems to be fit again, would it be worth reverting to the back three tried at the beginning of the 17-18 season, given how well it worked? It might provide enough defensive cover to allow more creative players like Foden or Bernardo to be on the pitch with De Bruyne, especially given the fact that Aguero is being eased back into the team now, and Torres and Sterling can be used as options up front. Howard, what do you reckon? A back three, is that something that might suit this team?
It might do, yeah, because what you lose really is the width. Now, I'm no tactical expert, but if you looked at it, the struggles we've had from like Sterling and Mahrez out wide, this kind of solves that in a way, because obviously you've got two fullbacks instead higher up the pitch. If Laporte's coming back into form, and or you know his form will surely return at some point, well, then we have three excellent options at centre half, and to play them all makes sense. No one DM only needed, and yeah, you could, Bernardo and Foden, as mentioned in the question, can, I don't know, does Pep want to play them centrally? That's the issue, or will they just, you know, will they stay out wide? I think it's quite an option because, as I said, it could work better to have the likes of Foden and Bernardo drifting out wide and coming in than having what Miles and Sterling, for me, have still had very disappointing seasons so far. And even with Aguero back, it could work. But
yeah,
I'm just wondering, Pep, because we've started getting these clean sheets, I would not expect to see it soon, because I think he's just trying to perfect the system that we're currently shaping at the moment.
Yeah, that's the thing, isn't it, Adam? Why, when City are defending so well at the moment, why would you rock that boat?
Yeah, I think that's the only reason that would stop him going for that three at the back, because it's working so well at the back. And it's like I said before, I think this is the best defensively we've been under Pep. And interesting, a couple of seasons ago, when Pep was asked why he doesn't play Gabriel Jesus and Aguero together a lot, and he said it's because Mendy's not fit. And I guess he sees Mendy bombing down that line and whipping balls in for both Aguero and Jesus. So I think if we did play three at the back with Mendy out wide, would see a lot more goals being scored, because I think Pep would actually want two strikers on the pitch in Gabriel Jesus and Aguero. It's just something I remember him saying a couple of seasons ago. So he certainly had that thought process, like the question suggests as well. So I could certainly see us scoring more goals. I just worry what it would do at the back after we've finally seemed to have sorted that.
Yeah, it would though, Adam, solve the blasted inverted wingers problem.
Oh yeah, I'm sick to death of that. The dreaded word of inverted wingers and double pivot will haunt me for the rest of this season.
Anything, yeah. But then Mendy's disappeared now, hasn't he? So don't know. Is he out of favour a bit at the moment? But with Cancelo getting game time, so I mean, play Cancelo, I guess, bombing up that side. But of course, not a left footer, so. I just don't think Pep would gamble with it just yet. Maybe later in the season.
No,
I don't know.
Yeah, I think it's going all right. We don't need to roll the dice just yet. Like you say, we seem to be picking up a bit of form. We seem to be shoring up, and I don't think he's going to roll the dice just yet.
Yeah, well, I'm drifting in and out of confidence for this season. After the two draws the other week, I was like, they're never going to do anything this season. You know, all it takes is a win in the league and a win in the Carabao Cup. And suddenly I'm like, yeah, you know, they're only a couple of points. Win the game in hand, they're only a couple of points off the top. They'll do it. They're going to do it. So yeah, I honestly have no idea how to read this season. So
Cloud nine for Christmas.
Cloud nine for Christmas.
They're not losing many games, so I don't know. We'll be a cup side this season. We'll see.
We'll see. Well, that brings to an end our final show before Christmas. But don't worry, there's plenty of Blue Moon podcasts to look forward to over the coming weeks. First up, this week's Patreon bonus show is a look at the players that have featured for both City and their opposition for the next game, Newcastle. That's available for everybody who backs by $2 a month or more, and you'll get 4 or 5 bonus shows a month for that $2 as well. So it's well worth the money, even though I would say that myself, wouldn't I? All the details are on patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast. On top of that, we'll be back on Christmas Day as 9 of our regulars are taking part in a big City quiz. It's all a big laugh, and it's perfect for when you're peeling the spuds or trying to get a few minutes away from the rest of the family. These two are in it as well, and I don't want to give anything away, but you know, there are people who do cover themselves in glory and people who don't, so I'm not going to say who's who, but that's going to be in your feeds from Christmas Day morning. If you've enjoyed the show, please go and give it a rating and a review in all the usual places. It does help others find us, and that helps us pay the bills with the ads as well. Thanks to my guests this week, Adam Carter.
Thank you very much.
And Howard Hocking.
Thanks for having me on.
Have a lovely Christmas, and we'll be back after the quiz show with another regular podcast next week before the new year. See you then.
Was the Blue Moon Podcast. Please support the show. Patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast.